Hey, everyone. Thank you for joining me on the BIPOC Outside podcast. I'm Chris Cromwell, and today we're sitting down with Nikki Lagosi-Shen. Nikki is an assistant professor at the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta, a world traveler, polyglot, and a qualitative scholar specializing in international indigeneity, BIPOC Indigenous relations, nationhood, identity, and structural racism. So let's get into it, shall we? Nikki, thank you so much for joining me. How are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for asking, Chris. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this one. So let's jump right into it. What is your approach to being in the outdoors?
It's an interesting question, and I hadn't thought of it. I'm not an athlete, so I don't think of myself as an outdoors person, but I'm always outside. I always want to walk. I love walking and talking meetings where they're possible. Even things like bringing the outdoors in, right? Having windows open, working with the lights off, and just having natural light.
I love that. But you're also a world traveler. So tell me what it is that you love about travel.
What I love about travel, I think getting outside of your own head. First of all, I think a lot of my greatest ideas, whether it's for work or just solving life's problems, have happened on either long road trips, long train rides, or long plane rides. So it's not just the destination, it's even the getting there, where you're in this almost liminal space of getting from point A to point B, and you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have the daily grind. You're just there in the moment, often just listening to music or playing video games without a care in the world. And then in terms of the actual destination, you don't realize how small your world is until you get outside of it. So just being exposed to other people, different ways of life, and a reminder to relax and roll with it, right? When you travel, it's like planning a wedding, right? Something's going to go wrong. So you just got to chill, right? Connections are going to get missed. You might not find Snapple iced tea in said country, right? You might get lost. So even just having to figure those things out and navigate sometimes broken language and signing and pointing with other people. But again, just it gets you out of that every day, right? It gets you thinking, yeah, thinking more deeply.
So tell me about one of your favorite travel adventures.
Oh, you told me you were going to ask this question, and I gave it a lot of thought, and I still can't distill it to one.
So give me more than one.
Okay, I'm going to get it down to a couple. And this got me thinking too. So the first one I would say is doing rock parkour. So this is trying to scale rocks and everything in an obstacle course kind of way, with my daughter in Victoria, BC, and on the way to Beacon Hill Park. Another one would be bungee jumping in Nanaimo. And what got me thinking about that is it's not just the adventure, it's the place. And for me, life is too short to be landlocked. My favorite place in the whole wide world is the ocean. And I realize that takes up like 3/4 of the globe, and that's intentional, right? Like, especially the Pacific. It's like a magical place to be. So, and it's also the people you're with. Although I didn't bungee jump with my daughter, she was there. And so when I think about the best travel adventures, whether it's having problems finding good food or missing train connections or, yeah, rock parkour, wherever in the world, when she's there, it's been awesome. So it's the place and it's the people for sure.
That's lovely. I really like that. Tell me what your thoughts are, like, as an Indigenous woman, when you're traveling, being a guest in other people's territories and spaces and respectful visiting.
That's an interesting one, because you don't realize how Canadian or how Indigenous you are until you leave Canada or Indigenous territory, right? Or cities with a lot of other Métis and Cree people in them. So, yeah, I think it's similar to being a good guest in someone's house. Right? You're not going to expect it to look exactly like your house. You're going to use your manners. You're going to roll with it, right? And you're going to follow the customs and such, and not measuring or judging, I think, other cultures or practices or social norms against things that we take for granted. So for instance, in Indonesia, I had no problem, even though it was plus 40, I had no problem covering up and being modest, right? The beach is a place for a bathing suit. Right? in restaurants or around the locals, it's not. It's not appropriate. So rather than judging it, saying, well, it's fine, or it's just a tourist destination. Hey, I'm a guest in your house, right? I'm going to take my shoes off and I'm going to sit where you tell me to. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in terms of even, yeah, being Indigenous and being visible, especially in countries like countries around Europe, where they have a very romanticized idea and stereotype about what Indigenous people look like. As soon as locals find out, this has been my experience in a few different places. A lot of times when locals find out that you are Indigenous, okay, first of all, they're shocked. Because I guess I am supposed to be in deer hide with beads, perhaps having darker skin with some feathers, right? Not supposed to be a world traveler, not supposed to be wearing business type of clothes. And then all of a sudden you have rock star status, right? And you're not paying for your food or drinks because they're like, wow. So it's almost like this interesting status.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just like a mythological creature has like emerged in front of them.
Yeah, and it's just this is idea of awesomeness, right? Like, tell me about it. And questions that ignorant, but not necessarily coming from a bad place, right? Like, do you live on a reserve, right? Like, do you go hunting? One of the best questions I was asked just last summer in Budapest from, we'll leave names out, from a person who was highly educated, but had never been to Canada, let alone knowing anything about Indigenous peoples in Canada, asked if I ate bear meat.
Bear meat.
Bear meat. That was pretty well. And then I burst out laughing because I thought it was a joke. But it comes from these Winnetou storybooks and movies, that franchise that's so popular in Central Europe. Yeah. So no bear meat for me.
Yeah. Bear meat's pretty greasy. I don't know that I'd recommend it to anybody. Just my personal experience. But that's such an interesting perspective of like, reminding yourself of the context of which questions are being asked and not necessarily always assuming it's coming from a negative place.
Yeah, and it would be easy to do that. My whole research, a lot of my teaching and my research is centered on racism, structural racism, and everyday type of racism, right? That often comes veiled in rude questions or assumptions. But again, yeah, it's the context, right? So not to say that it's okay, but also not to get really angry and get into a tense situation, understanding that, okay, given the lack of education and awareness, right, that this person had, it wasn't meant in a negative way. So I certainly corrected them, right? Now, if they ask that again, right, that's a different story, right? Now you're being willfully ignorant, right? But especially in today's day and age with the internet and such.
Yeah, Google is in fact free.
It is free.
And I was so excited to get you on the show this season. We've been having a lot of discussions away from sports specifically and more about DEI and where it's failing and where it is succeeding, race and racism, indigeneity, all of these different things. And I was so excited to get you on because you are an educator in addition to being a polyglot and a world traveler. And so you originally, your discipline is actually political science and you specialize in populism, indigeneity, and minority rights. So what inspired that?
I would say that I was always leaning toward it from the time that I was a young tween and teenager. I was always drawn to metal and punk music and like goth industrial music. A lot of these bands have very political type of lyrics. So I was always very opinionated and aware of current events. While I've enjoyed a lot of privileges, such as growing up in an industrialized country like Canada, being Western educated and so on, I didn't have a lot of privileges growing up. So I feel like I was the underdog and I could totally relate, right? So the research was really just about finding like language and theories to unpack and make sense of my own experiences. And myself, whether it's political science or even Indigenous studies, a lot of times Indigenous peoples or peoples from Eastern Europe are treated as if they're in silos. So they're totally separate groups. But that's not my experience, right? And as someone very urban, someone Canadian of mixed ancestry, I feel like my experience probably isn't so unique. I'm probably like a lot of Canadians. Yet I don't see that reflected anywhere. So that's really why I was so interested in in a lot of these topics and social justice topics.
And so what does it, this has been an ongoing topic. What does it take to become an expert in areas to be able to educate on things like minority rights, on microaggressions, on structural racism? That's a huge question. And I know you educate in all of these areas. You can pick one or talk about all of them. Maybe if I frame it this way, if I wanted to bring someone in to talk to one of the groups that I'm hosting about these issues, what sort of expertise should I be looking for?
You're right. That is a big question. And I'm really loath to call myself an expert. I suppose I am. And my credentials say I am. But it's always that humility that I think that we should have. On the one hand, there's the formal education and degrees and credentials that go along with that type of training, right? So, you know, the bachelor's, the master's, in my case, the PhD to be teaching at the university level. However, that's not required for everyone, right? Like, people can specialize even with a bachelor's degree, right? Like in industry, in government. So it's a matter of about education and upskilling. And there are so many opportunities now with the web, right? To upskill, there's so many courses to take. And in terms of leadership, it's always about challenging yourself, I think. This might not be directly answering your question, but I think one personality trait that it takes, aside from the credentials, is to keep pushing yourself and keep questioning yourself, right? So there's always new learning to do or unlearning, right? Like, that's a progress. It's not a checkbox list.
In your personal opinion, do you think lived experience is necessary or helps in achieving that expertise?
It certainly can motivate and inspire people. I think it can help, but it can also hinder. Let me explain this. Because, for instance, myself as an urban Indigenous woman, sure, my own experiences can help me make sense of some of the issues with structural racism or other its own effects based on my own life experiences. But I'm also not an ambassador for all Indigenous women, right? So this is where it can hinder. Right? So just because you're a member of a BIPOC community or part of the genderqueer community or whatnot, doesn't mean that you are automatically a representative for all of these peoples. And this is going back to the point about the learning is ongoing.
I like that. That's a really important distinction. I really like that. So we've seen, especially since 2020, with the protest cycle after the murder of George Floyd, with the protest cycle after Every Child Matters in Canada, a lot of proposed DEI initiatives, and then suddenly a lot of proposed DEI experts. So what is the consequence of doing work in these areas without having an expertise, without having a foundational education in these matters?
That's a really great question and an immediate concern, I think, because these issues are really, very deeply rooted. They're very complex and they're context dependent. There's not a one size fits all. Okay, here's structural racism 101. Here are the solutions 101. It looks different in different spaces and different places. And so with that, for folks to just come in and think another policy or a cluster hire, targeted hires, these kinds of interventions, while well-intended, perhaps, still leave systems of power in place and unquestioned. In other words, they're band-aid solutions, right? So it's not a question of representation, right? Oh, well, we need more Black employees, we need more Indigenous employees, and so on and so forth, right? We need to understand, well, what are the problems within these different institutions and workspaces. And that requires learning. It requires educating. It requires that upskilling, if you will.
So you teach on structural racism at a variety of levels. And I know you and I know each other through the university. What is your approach to teaching on these topics to lay audiences? Because I know you teach in the public. I know you teach in the industry. We're going to talk about the micro course in a little bit. How do you approach it differently? Or
I would say I just use less isms and ifications, if you will, right? And not that it's completely so high-level academic. It depends on your audience, right? If you can't explain something And this is not to say watering down the content or dumbing it down or whatever kind of terms that we want, but it's about meeting your audience where they're at, right? It's not like a hierarchy of, oh, somehow this kind of knowledge is better. It's specialized, right? So even in using language of political science or Indigenous studies, somebody with equal university credentials in a different discipline wouldn't necessarily understand and unpack. So it's about, okay, real life examples. And I think this comes from my political science training, that we're looking at the theory and we're always thinking about the applicability and the so what factor. So talking with the public, it's about, okay, how to explain these concepts in detail that everyone can understand, regardless, and not assuming education levels or even discipline levels. And then just thinking of real world examples that are relevant and helping people think about how to reflect and connect some of these big concepts we hear in the media all the time. First of all, to define them in ways that make sense. Second, to then think about how might they apply in their everyday lives, be it in their work or social spaces.
Right.
Online spaces as well.
Absolutely. So going to the course, which is geared towards a more broader audience than what you might have in the classroom, the Structural Racism micro course that is available online, what was the impetus and goals for that?
Wow. Yeah, the Tackling Structural Racism course. This was a response through a bunch of us in the faculty after the very disappointing decision regarding the George Stanley trial after the death of Colton Bushy, where although the media framed this act of violence as a one-off, those familiar with Indigenous studies and this rather darker side of Canadian, I'm loath to say history, because it's still happening.
Reality.
Right? It's not really a one-off when these same kinds of incidents keep happening again and again, spanning decades. So it was a faculty initiative of, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? And of course, our students who are either in our degree program or taking our class are already asking these critical questions and are interested in these questions. So it was also about reaching a broader audience. As you mentioned, this isn't a university course. Although it's offered through the university, it's what we call a micro-credential, meaning that the targeted audience are everyday professionals. And so the course is structured as, pardon the pun, structured into four modules. The first one is that definitions piece, where, again, buzzwords that we hear in the media, like privilege, like structural racism, like the difference between prejudice and discrimination, microaggressions. These sound great and might make for nice clickbait, but a lot of folks don't really understand what there's not a working definition of what they mean. So our very first module is about, okay, how do we take all these buzzwords and make sense of them with examples? And then we move into the next three modules, which are different case studies. So we've got K-12 education, social services, so family and social services, and the legal system. And although those examples draw on those particular workplaces, the course is broad. And the instances, what we can observe, for instance, in education, we could also see in the corporate world, in the public sector, in other spaces. So although folks might think, oh, well, I'm not in ed, I'm not in social services, this doesn't apply to me, it's not the case, because the cases are just showing examples of where we see those concepts in action. If we were to look at every workplace, every sector, right, we could probably have 100 modules. But again, the learning is about, okay, here's where we see it in these spaces. How do we apply it in others?
Now, the course itself is fairly accessible. It's internet-based, first of all.
Yeah.
And it's fairly plain language compared to the space that I typically see you in. Was that important? Was that thought through?
Oh, that was absolutely important. Because again, we're not targeting a university audience, but rather a broad sector of the public and anyone interested. Another thing with the course that, another impetus for the course and what's unique about it is it's not about blame. It's not about guilt. It's about looking for solutions together and equipping people with those kinds of tools. And it starts with education, right? We keep talking about education and EDI and people educating and upskilling. themselves. So it's a good start to learning where to find that education and getting that piece in place.
Talking about that, I want to, you said blame and guilt, and that I stubbed my toe on that immediately, because learning about structural racism can be uncomfortable.
And it should.
Right?
Absolutely. When we're talking about structural racism, when we're talking about violence, discrimination, and so on, these aren't comfortable topics. You shouldn't feel good. This isn't a cake and cookies, a conversation. And so while the material is uncomfortable, again, it's not about trying to point fingers and blame, but about looking at what everyday practices that are realities for many people, attitudes and assumptions that underlie all of our institutions. And
as an instructor, when you come across that discomfort, that reaction of like people freezing and looking inward because they're experiencing that discomfort, how do you overcome that? Do you have any advice to overcome that?
I think that's real, where the real growth is happening. There's a distinction between discomfort and triggering. Those are two different processes. So in terms of discomfort, given the topics, given the titles of the modules, folks know what they're getting into when they're taking the course. It's not going to be a sunshine and roses type of topic. But again, I think where the turning point is to have these discussions. Our country is wonderful, it's beautiful, but it's not without its problems. And Canada has done a very good job, a good PR job globally, of presenting itself as the ultimate success model of multiculturalism. So, you know, when you think on, especially in that global arena, people don't think of Canada as having a race problem, right? And we're often seen as the nice neighbor, especially compared to the US. So these can also be uncomfortable conversations for people to have, because it's chapters in the textbook that they never read, right? They were never added to a lot of the social studies textbooks. And this is changing now. And that's positive. In my classes and in my teaching and in my public talks, I also point to successes, because even take gay marriage, right? 30 years ago, that would not have even been on the table. And so, not to say that, okay, homophobia doesn't exist and any of these things, but to say that these issues we're talking about are deeply ingrained and the result of centuries of policies based on racialized and colonial assumptions about different people. We're not going to fix it in a day. And so with that, change is slow, but it also does happen. Silence is the enemy in this regard. So even being able to have a frank conversation and educate ourselves is a great starting point. Looking towards those successes and thinking about, okay, how do we move toward more successes, I think is motivation to keep people going. If you feel like it's completely hopeless, yeah, that's a bad place to be.
That hopeless element's something that we're talking about. We're having two different conversations in the outdoor industry right now. One is about eco-anxiety and about people just really not feeling good about the realities of climate change. And the other one is this anxiety that has yet to be labeled, or maybe I haven't come across the label yet, for people that are working in more areas that we're working in terms of equity in the outdoors. And it feels like the temperature has been turned up in the last little while, since maybe 2016 or 2020. But certainly conversations about equity in the outdoors are being met with more resistance now, it feels like, in some spaces. Are you experiencing that? Do you have any advice for those of us who are early career or trying to make changes in these spaces about that anxiety? Given that your background is both in political science and understanding how political systems work and how they evolve over time, but then also your expertise in structural racism. Any thoughts about that? That's incredibly broad and not something that we had talked about in advance. But if you do have thoughts on that, I would like to hear them.
I have a lot of thoughts about them. I'll try to keep them contained so this doesn't end up being a 15-hour podcast. Where to start? I think my best advice to folks looking to do this kind of work, it can be exhausting for sure. It can be very frustrating to feel like you're hitting a wall, speaking to a wall, is to focus on the people who want to hear you, right? When I think about my role as an educator, it's not my job to try to tell somebody else how to think or what to think. It's my job to point to education, different facts than they may not know, open up and encourage dialogue and thoughtfulness, and equip people with the tools to do that and ask those critical questions. If someone is unwilling to have these kinds of discussions, if someone is in a space where they're not willing to learn, it's not my job to try to convince them of anything, right? It's not a judge or jury. So I would say, if you're always trying to convince, say, your friends on social media who don't think like you do, right? That's just going to get them defensive. If you're just going to show up at to counter protest, right? Not to counter protest. There's nothing wrong with that. But if your purpose is that you're going to change the minds of the people there, you're going to hit a brick wall every time and you're going to burn out and it's going to be fruitless. But rather focus the energy on folks who are willing to learn and listen with you.
That's important. I'm going to try to keep that with me because that's important.
It's easy to get into debates, right? And there's a time and a place.
Yeah. Yeah. Switching directions a little bit. Tell me about innovative social pedagogies. And for our listeners, first of all, what is pedagogies? This is a broad audience. So let's start there and then tell me about innovative social pedagogies.
So pedagogy really broadly is like modes of teaching and ways of teaching. And this is very general, not specific to university or whatnot. So ways of thinking, ways of teaching, most simply. Right? There's a whole other science behind it, but that's our working definition for this purpose here. We call it ISP for short because, like every industry, we love acronyms. So ISP is spearheaded by Dr. Vivek Venkatesh at Concordia University in Montreal. And it's a multi-university initiative between us at the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta, some folks over at the University of Chicoutimi in Quebec, and folks at Concordia. ISP is an umbrella project with a whole bunch of side projects. So some of the side projects that we've worked on include, similar to structural racism, but a free MOOC, massive open online course, called From Hate to Hope. We've done iterations of that course, having live conversations as folks are working through the material themselves over the four-week course. That one's targeted at recognizing hate speech online and what to do about it. And that's a huge issue on its own. Some of the other things have included funding for community-based research teams. So here in Edmonton, a lot of the work has been through Third Space Playback Theatre, which is also known as Theatre of the Oppressed, working with different community members here in Edmonton with their initiatives. Note I'm saying working with, not for, or trying to help or save or fix, right? Because that's not what we're doing. We don't look at BIPOC communities in that way, but rather, hey, maybe they're working on an advertising campaign or so. Yeah, working with in those different spaces.
So that's really incredible. So again, meeting people where they are, working with people in community, and working for people in community is the approach to ISP.
Absolutely. And I would even say our entire Faculty of Native Studies approach, right, is, yeah, working with, not speaking for, saving, or fixing.
Yeah, critical. So what about you? Now, course is online, it's available. What's next? Any upcoming projects that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I'm going to be going on my sabbatical soon. And so I will be spending the summer doing a lot of outside things, of course, like swimming, like hiking, certainly some traveling. Where to? Don't know yet. I'll see where it takes me. But also spending the next few months consolidating all my research. I've had incredible opportunities to be on a bunch of amazing different projects. Yeah, so really about consolidating all that research and finding a clear path forward and deciding which direction I want to go.
That's awesome. I respect deeply the idea that you are not on social media. I'm jealous. And I wish that I could break away. I'm going to link the ISP work, the Hate to Hope course, definitely the micro course on structural racism. Is there any other educational resources that you think that our listeners would benefit by looking into and engaging with?
Absolutely. I can think of a free one, and it's video-based with transcripts, so completely accessible for different folks. And that is the Indigenous Canada MOOC. So Indigenous Canada Massive Open Online Course. This is 12 modules and it's free. There is a pay option if folks are looking for a digital badge to add to their LinkedIn and these CVs. Otherwise, it's free. So it's video based. And what's really cool about this piece is it has 12 modules on pretty well everything Indigenous Canada, right? So from history to current initiatives, gender specific issues, modern day things. So it's a really good place to start for folks to get that education that we keep talking about. It's super accessible, really interesting. And a few years back, although the course is self-paced and people take it on their own, Dan Levy had quite famously over YouTube with some professors in the faculty followed the course online, and there were weekly discussions for each module. And so that's all on YouTube for free if listeners wanted to take the modules and then watch the faculty and Dan Levy discussions after.
Now, I remember following that on Instagram. That was a lot of fun. And even though it does say Indigenous Canada, and of course there are significant differences between Canada and the US, there is some applicability there.
I would say legally there's different agreements and terms, but it absolutely is relevant for a North American audience and not just a BIPOC audience, right? This is Indigenous land. So there's some learning for everyone. There's something for everyone.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I will definitely link that one. Thank you for that reminder. Nikki, I really appreciate this. It's given me a lot to think about, particularly about my own approach and speaking to people who are available to hear me. When doing this work, it's been really lovely to unpack some of the broader conversations we've had so far this season with someone who is an expert in this field. And I super appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.
And that is it for this episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Links on where to find the resources Nikki and I talked about are available in the show notes at BIPOCOutside.com. I hope this episode gave you something to think about and inspired you to learn more. If it did, please don't hesitate to smash the like button. I hope you'll join us again for another episode of BIPOC Outside.